This is Fresh Air. I always like 10 best lists. They give you a chance to compare your taste with the critic who's prepared the list, and they help put the year in focus. We asked Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff to make out his list of the 10 best movies of the year, and here he is to present it.
Let's start with number 10, to create suspense. The 10th best movie of the year, I thought, was Malcolm X, Spike Lee's long biography and long-awaited biography of Malcolm X. The 9th, I thought, was One False Move, Carl Franklin's hard-hitting independent film. 8, Best Intentions, also long, Billy August's film of Ingmar Bergman's screenplay about his own life. 7, a little film that I just thought was terrific, called Proof, by the Australian director Jocelyn Moorhouse. 6, American Dream, that's Barbara Kopple's actually Oscar-winning documentary, but it wasn't released. It won an Oscar, I believe, in 1990, but it wasn't released until this year. Maybe it was the 1991 Oscar, but it wasn't released until this year to theaters. Number 5, Aladdin, the Walt Disney cartoon. Number 4, Howard's End, Merchant Ivory version of the E.M. Forster novel. Number 3, The Player, Robert Altman's great comeback film. Number 2, The Crying Game, Neil Jordan's wonderful film. And number 1, Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood's wonderful movie, his best movie ever.
Well, that's a really interesting list. And, you know, some of the films on those lists, I think, kind of epitomize certain issues that really came to the fore this year. So let's look at some of the films and some of the issues that tie into them. Why don't we start with One False Move, which was number 9 on your list. And this is an excellent independent film. Do you think that this was a particularly good year for independent films? And are this year's independent films different in any fundamental way from what we're used to seeing?
Yeah, I think this was a banner year for independent films. There was something really special going on that has been building for a long time. Because, you know, it used to be that an independent film, for a long time it seemed to us critics that an independent film was something that came from Sundance and it had a young girl coming of age and there was a lot of hay, you know, around. And this year, they were really individual visions. They were not, because independent film used to come from a single sensibility in a way, and now it comes from all over the map. You have, you know, violent genre films like One False Move and Reservoir Dogs. You had coming-of-age films like Gas Food Lodging, but it was a very good, very fresh look at things. My New Gun, a quirky film just out of nowhere, just out of the sensibility of its maker, Stacey Cochran. Swoon, which dared to examine the Leopold Loeb murders once again. Laws of Gravity, kind of gritty, you know, outer borough movie. The Hours and the Times, which it took as its subject the most peculiar thing, the relationship between John Lennon and Brian Epstein. So, I mean, it was a terrific year for independent film. Not all of them were great, but they all showed a sensibility that could go anywhere.
Number 2 on your list of the 10 best was The Crying Game, written and directed by the Irish director Neil Jordan, who made a couple of films in America and went back to Ireland and England to work again. Are you glad he left Hollywood?
Yeah, I am glad he left Hollywood. And I've talked to him. He's glad he left Hollywood, too, because the movies he made in Hollywood were bad, and this is his best movie ever. I mean, this is really an astonishing, wonderful movie. And this is something apropos of the independent filmmakers that we ought to take a look at. It takes a lot of bravery. It takes a lot of courage to sort of shun Hollywood, to say no, thank you, no, thank you to the limos and the money and the fame and the easier entree into things like the Academy Awards. But sometimes you have to do it in order to make good movies. It's pretty rare to find a Clint Eastwood who can work sort of independently within the system. Now, all these people who are wonderful independent filmmakers are going to get Hollywood offers. Many of them already have. You see them succumb one by one. A good example this year is Beban Kidron, who made the, you know, sort of amusing trifle Antonia and Jane, that which we saw last year, and said, well, something good might come of this person. So then she goes to Hollywood and she makes Used People, which I just think is dreck. I mean, it's a movie that it's as bad as any movie made this year, and exposes the limitations to her talent. And I think that people who have a vision need not be fed a new vision by Hollywood. We saw a lot of actors, a lot of directors who had done pretty well on their own, kind of come a cropper this year in Hollywood. You know, Stephen Frears, who has managed to kind of maintain an independence, finally went Hollywood this year. He had made Hollywood films before, but they were sort of on his own terms. This year he made one on Hollywood's terms, and it was Hero, and it was just bad, just plain bad. And you do, you know, you see that happening. So it would be very nice to have a kind of system where people can continue to work on their own in their own way. It would be nice to have national cinemas, like a thriving British cinema and even a thriving Irish cinema, which almost seemed to happen this year, to nurture talents like that.
One of the films on your 10 best list, The Player, weighing in at number 3. It was
you like this, don't you?
Yeah.
Top 10.
Yeah, that's a satire about Hollywood, a very funny satire about Hollywood. And that was directed by Robert Altman. It kind of gave Altman a new credibility in Hollywood. Any other films that you feel revived people's careers this year?
Well, let me before I get to that, say something about Robert Altman. Because Altman, you know, has had a funny career, and it was in the doldrums for a long time. He lived in Paris for a while, and I made some very interesting movies there. Vincent and Theo is a wonderful movie, but this, of course, was his big comeback film, and it's a great movie, and everyone loved it. And Hollywood kept saying to him, "Come on home, Bob. All is forgiven." And Bob said, "Ah, get out of here. I don't need you guys." And it will be very interesting to see if at the Oscars he gets snubbed a bit, because of course this is one of the obviously in my book it's one of the top 5, and I would think in anyone's book it should be one of the 5 nominees for Best Picture at the Oscars. But he has been so kind of back at you, you know, so sort of nose-thumbing towards Hollywood, even since they've said all is forgiven. It'll be interesting to see whether they're willing to keep him in their good graces. As for other people who've come back, I mean, Clint Eastwood, it's the most remarkable example, because people were saying, "Ah, Clint, I guess it's over." Even the stars with the greatest longevity finally have to go downhill. And Clint came back this year with his masterpiece, Unforgiven, the best film he's made, one of the best Westerns of the last 2 decades, a film that both comments on the Western, demythologizes it in a way that we're familiar with, and then remythologizes it
so that
it gives you absolutely everything. It's one of his best performances. There are wonderful performances throughout. It has a really solid screenplay by David Webb Peoples. And, man, it's good, and it's great to see Clint Eastwood in that position. Merchant Ivory, who, if you had asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, "Please, I never want to see another one of their kind of pallid classic adaptations with sort of so-so acting and a literal-minded script." Howard's End is the best film they've made. They, you know, after the better part of 2 decades working together, or maybe it's going on 3. I think it's going on 3.
Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the year in film with critic Stephen Schiff. What were the big formulas of the year that everybody was copying, hoping to really cash in on?
Well, you know, there's a new genre that we've all kind of watched creep up on us over the last few years that really kind of reached critical mass this year. And people have come up with various names for it or have not quite identified it as a genre yet. I call it the indoor psycho movie. And this year, it seemed that every month there was a movie like The Hand That Rocks the Cradle or Unlawful Entry or Single White Female. Indoor psycho movies, because the psycho is in your house. You know, you've welcomed him, or one member of your family has welcomed him, and he's, you know, he might be your husband or your wife or your roommate or your nanny or you know, the cop who loves you and who saves you, whatever it might be. These movies have been around a long time. And, I mean, there are sort of classic versions. Rosemary's Baby is one of them. But this year, it just seemed to be everywhere at all times. And the formula got so tired that kind of, that one like Single White Female, where the acting was rather good and the direction was rather deft, just the fact that 5 minutes into the film you knew everything that was going to happen made it pall a bit. I prefer not to see one for a while, a little moratorium on these movies from hell.
One of the reasons why you knew everything that was going to happen is that you'd seen it already in The Coming Attractions. That's another trend that really reached crisis point this year. Coming Attractions that tell you the whole movie.
It's as though the people who cut together the trailers have become sort of auteurs in their own right. And they get a lot of attention from Hollywood, because a trailer really is a very important marketing device. And so that it's almost as though they're deciding to re-edit the film on their own. There's a pretty good film, Lorenzo's Oil, that's just opening in New York now and will open wider. And it's as disease of the week films go, it's about as good as it could be. But when you see the trailer, which is kind of very artistic and tells the entire story without a word, you just feel, well, I've seen that. I mean, if you hadn't already seen every Disease of the Week movie you wanted to see, you've sure seen it after the trailer. And yes, Single White Female had a trailer like that. It happens again and again and again.
I remember last year when we were going through your 10 best list, you pointed out that some of the most dramatic, compelling images people watched, images they couldn't tear themselves away from, happened on television, and what people were watching was real life, the war in the Gulf, the coup in the Soviet Union. Do you see that pattern continuing into this year?
Yeah, I really do. I think this is the second year in a row that events have kind of overtaken movies. I mean, the movies did pretty well in terms of ticket sales this year. You had probably the fourth biggest year commercially in history, not accounting for inflation. But still, nothing at the movies. It was sort of as though real life took the place in the culture that the movies had once taken in terms of sort of plot and characters and twists and turns and characters who were both compelling and mysterious. Nothing could beat the election. No movie could beat the election. You know, the emergence of Ross Perot, the disappearance, the reappearance of Ross Perot, the Clinton scandals, his overcoming of the scandals, Bush plummeting in the polls, scraping his way back. You know, I mean, all this stuff was just amazing to watch. And really, you know, no movie could match it for entertainment value and for the kind of the way it brought up issues and made us talk about them. And, you know, on a smaller scale, a good example of how this phenomenon is acting in American life was the sort of Woody Mia scandal. Because, you know, the Woody Allen Mia Farrow scandal was such a big thing in sort of what people talked about and how people kind of gauged their reactions to, you know, the constant battle of the sexes, et cetera, et cetera. But when it was played out on the screen in a movie by Woody Allen called Husbands and Wives, no one went. And that was fascinating to see. I mean, it was fascinating to see really Woody and Mia as a scandal took the place in terms of the culture, in terms of what we view as entertainment that the movie should have taken.
Spike Lee has a knack of making feature films that actually tap into the reality of the moment. Do the Right Thing was really related to what happened in Howard Beach. Jungle Fever, very related to interracial relationships. How do you think Malcolm X succeeded in tapping into what's happening now politically?
Well, you know, this is interesting, Terry. This is another example of the way events overtook movies. Spike Lee's movie Malcolm X didn't succeed in doing that, and it's failing at the box office. And Spike Lee is such a master of PR that he's sort of outdone himself this time. He's been a PR master to a fault, because all the controversy surrounding Malcolm X and all the issues that the making of Malcolm X raised became much more prominent in the culture than the movie itself. So once the movie was finally released, everyone in a way had enough of Malcolm X. And when it turned out that it was a rather thoughtful kind of, sort of understated, long, a discursive movie about Malcolm X that didn't take a kind of incendiary point of view, but took Malcolm X's life in sections and examined each one and left it to the reader, to the viewer, to decide. Suddenly, everyone sort of shrugged and said, "Well, that's not relevant to the issues at hand. It's a nice biopic, you know, and biopics can be a problem."
Well, while we're speaking of real life versus movies, we should mention the documentary on your 10 best list. That's American Dream, Barbara Kopple's documentary about the labor movement, focusing in on a meatpacking strike. It was a really complicated movie. It wasn't just, you know, pro or con labor. It was really examining the complicated decisions that labor had to make.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, documentarians will hate me for saying this, but we really see greatness in a documentary when we feel sort of this could be fiction. This is as thrilling as fiction, or more so, when the issues brought up and the conflicts brought up have a real innate drama, when the characters are characters and they represent things the way, you know, a great novelist can make a character represent things. All that happened in American Dream without her manipulating anyone, without her falsifying anything. I think it was a magnificent job.
Are there any movies you're especially looking forward to that you know are coming out early next year?
You know, it seems to me there are two movies that sort of come to mind when you say that. One, I don't think it's coming out early, but we got deprived this year of Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence, and because it was just moved back till next year. Mm. I am dying to see it.
Yeah.
Another movie that I have seen in rough cut that is very, very good is This Boy's Life, directed by the previously unspectacular Michael Caton Jones, but it's really not a director's movie. It's from the Tobias Wolff kind of autobiography, and it has a wonderful Robert Getchell screenplay, and it is really strong, and it opens April 2nd.
I can't wait to see that because I really love the writing in the book. Well, I'm going to ask you a favor. For our listeners who are planning to go to the movies over this holiday weekend, of what's playing now, what would you most recommend?
The Crying Game.
I'll second that.
Hands down.
Well, Stephen, have a real happy new year.
The same to you, Terry.
And talk to you soon.
Good.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic and critic at large for The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air.